A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Yesterday's conversation on the choices that we've made to double, more than double, child poverty caught a lot of attention. You know, a lot of email, a lot of response. And look, virtually all of it pointing out that it's disgraceful that in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at its wealthiest moment, we've got kids who go to bed hungry. And what I'm thrilled and happy about is people are seeing that this was a choice. That we have made a decision. Our elected leaders made a choice. And look, we know who they are. And that's a good thing because we can get rid of them. We can choose to send them packing, send them back to where they belong. I had someone today say to me that they really couldn't believe that the Republicans would fight feeding children. And I said, you know, what makes you think, given decades, literally decades of bad policy and showing us repeatedly that they don't care about children, they don't care about poverty, they don't care about working people, they care about the ultra wealthy, they care about tax cuts for the rich. That has been the MO for a very long time. And look, it's in their rhetoric. Tax cuts, smaller government. Drag it in a bathtub, drown it. I mean, it's who they are. And this is the thing that I'm still struggling with, because I think we're coming around to the reality that Republicans hate working people. Look at all the things that they've done. But I don't think it's there yet, because I still think people want to believe that, you know, in their heart, you know, they really are, you know, somewhere deep down, really deep down, they're still decent. Because, you know, they tell us how religious they are. And yet you would think that the religious among us would be the ones going, hey, that guy we follow talked about feeding the hungry. In fact, did it. We should do that. But no. No. I mean, stop and think about the only accomplishment, legislative accomplishment, that happened during the 4 years of the Trump administration. And it was the tax cuts. In fact, Mitt Romney today talked about that. You know, Mitt Romney, who says he's not running for another term, you know, is now free to just come out and blast everything and said, look, you know, even that wasn't Trump's accomplishment. Even that wasn't the Republicans' accomplishment. It was Paul Ryan's. They have no policy. They have no platform. They have no vision for working people other than desperation. And I look at this and I go, you know, we chose, as a matter of policy, we chose to double, more than double, child poverty. That was a choice. Just like we could choose to end homelessness, we could choose to take care of our veterans, we could choose to do all of those things. We just don't. They're nice political issues we get to throw at each other, but as a matter of actually doing, we don't. And what we end up doing is we end up choosing desperation for some of our neighbors. And that's really what, you know, going and ending the child tax credit did. It was choosing the most vulnerable to be even more vulnerable, to be more desperate. And it comes back to this moment. And if you look around, you look at Iowa, you look at Arkansas, you look at a number of states across this country that are loosening child labor laws because, hey, we need cheap labor. We need to get those kids to work. You know, like the good old days. And you know, fortunately, no one this time came out and said, well, you're too hard on rich people, Rick. No, because I think we're finally waking up to the reality that the rich people, they only care about themselves for the most part. So when I played the clip of Tim Gerner, who, by the way, is worth more than $500 million, talking about we need to raise unemployment. We need to get those working people back into place. I had several people say, you know, you should play that clip again. In fact, you should play that clip often. And I got to tell you, I think I have to. So if you weren't here yesterday for Tim Gerner's his little spiel. Now, he's a real estate magnate from Australia, I believe. But this is his little song and dance.
I think the problem that we've had is that we have people decided they didn't really want to work so much anymore through COVID, and that has had a massive issue on productivity. You know, tradies have definitely pulled back on productivity. You know, they have been paid a lot to do not too much in the last few years. And we need to see that change. We need to see unemployment rise. Unemployment has to jump 40-50% in my view. We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around. I mean, there's been a systematic change where employees feel the employer is extremely lucky to have them, as opposed to the other way around. So it's a dynamic that has to change. We've got to kill that attitude, and that has to come through hurting the economy, which is what the whole global, you know, the world is trying to do. The governments around the world are trying to increase unemployment to get that to some sort of normality. And we're seeing it. I think every employer now is seeing it. I mean, there is definitely massive layoffs going off. People might not be talking about it, but people are definitely laying people off, and we're starting to see less arrogance in the employment market. And that has to continue because that will cascade across the cost balance.
Now, we most certainly have to have those people back in line. And you hear what he said? Governments are pushing for this. And he's right. We have a branch of our government doing just that. The Republicans have been trying to push for recession. They've been trying to starve the economy. They've been trying to push exactly what this guy's talking about. We got a Federal Reserve who's hell-bent on slamming on the brakes so that we do what? More unemployment. So that wages don't go up, because heaven forbid that happen. And I have to. There's so much here. This is one of those moments where you go, he's honest. He's at least on that front. He's honest. He's telling the truth. This is the view that he has of working people. And this is the view that the very wealthy have always had. You know, I remember doing research, you know, years ago when I was in college, because, you know, labor was part of my focus going through college. And I wrote a piece on child labor. And one of the there was a CEO back in the 1910s who said that, you know, you know, education is spoiled on children because it spoils them for work. If they get too much education, they won't want to work. And, you know, we need hand laborers. We need factory workers. We need grunts. We need, you know, too much education will, you know, destroy a workforce. And that attitude has not changed. It's just they don't say it out loud anymore. There's no more the quote attributed to Jay Gould, "I can pay half the working class to murder the other half." They don't say that anymore. But it's what they know, because it's what they do, and it's what they do very effectively. And I was, as I was going through the emails today and as I was responding and I was thinking about, you know, where we are. We're at a place right now where, understand, policymakers in these red states, the welfare states, the states that are living off of the government dole, who take more money from the federal government than they pay in, and then saying we need to destroy social programs and destroy food stamp programs because, you know, we need them hungry enough to go back to work. These are the ones pushing these child labor bills. Because, again, we need a flood of cheap labor to get back into the workforce. And this is the weird thing. And we're in a weird moment because corporate America, you know, they want immigration so that they can abuse cheap labor. And Republicans used to be on board with that. It's just now such a political football that we're going to sacrifice our children. This is what they're telling us. That they, at all costs, we're going to get cheap labor. Because they don't care about us. You know, I was remembering, you know, during COVID, you know, one of the meatpacking plants that, you know, they were out there, you know, betting on, you know, how many people they could get sick. They were out there betting on how many people would get COVID and how many of them would die and, you know, all this because they don't care about working people. And this is where in this moment right now, we have got to organize and come together and fight for permanence. And this is where you know, we a guest yesterday said, you know, Biden should be pushing for a higher minimum wage. Absolutely. But more importantly, we should be fighting for stronger laws to allow people to fight for better wages, hours, working conditions. Because understand, the people who are sitting in our boardrooms are the Tim Gerners of the world. And while your American CEOs aren't going to go out and say that in public, it's what they say in the dark. It's what they say to each other. It's the policies they push. Just look at the contract fights that have been going on. So are you surprised that a very wealthy guy would say, you know what? We need 50% more unemployment. We need desperation. We need pain. We need to get those people back into line. Are you surprised by it? Shouldn't be. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Donald Trump has fully embraced Putin's sympathetic comments. You remember yesterday we talked a little bit about Putin coming out and saying, what's happening with Trump is a persecution of a political rival for political motives. Putin says this shows the whole rottenness of the American system, which cannot claim to teach others about democracy. Now, again, as I said yesterday, this is a guy who, you know, poisons his political opponents. You know, think of the polonium 210T cocktail he served up. And this is a guy who's, you know, reportedly, you know, thrown journalists out of windows, turned a certain, mercenary into a lawn dart. To have him, you know, on your side, there used to be a time where you didn't embrace that. Not Trump, man. Someone said something nice about him. Someone said something nice about him. So he's got to embrace it. Even if it is a murderous dictator. What do you expect? What do you expect? Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Insane.
What's...
Okay. So... anyone who is embracing the idea that having Vladimir Putin on one side has totally lost the plot and jumped the shark. And, you know, it's amazing. We have them here in the United States, and they're in the Republican Party. And in Russia, you know, he is not even Russian. He is Georgian by birth. He was adopted. And he has been doing in, I guess, that has been brought up lately. And he has been doing in those who have been bringing it up. They've unfortunately, you know, fallen out of windows. Darn, so many people over there fall out of windows. They need to put bars on the windows. And, you know, drop down, drop
dead. Or nets.
Yeah, a net, you know, something.
Like they do in China to keep the people from killing themselves at the factories.
Exactly. So, and you were saying about the Republicans. They have never cared about the working class. My dad was born in 1908, passed away in 1992. And my dad was a lifetime Democrat. And he always said to everyone, because he was involved in local politics, and he would say to everyone, do you actually think that the Republican Party cares about you? Look at what they're doing. And I'm saying this 30-some years later after his death. Do you really think the Republican Party cares about you? Look at what they're doing. But, you know, they're all alike. We have, here in our little hamlet, we have five council members, and four of them are Republicans, you know, because we're a Republican town. But now that they've gotten on the council and they're trying to make, we have pretensions to being a homeowners association, apparently, our little population of 230 people, and they're trying to pass all these most ridiculous ordinances you've ever heard of in your life. So I've got a bullseye on my back because I went to the last meeting and I even said that, and I said, you know, you're supposed to be serving the people, not your own agenda. It's not your town. You're not a king or queen. You're a public servant. You know, and I just ran my mouth. So
I can see that.
But it doesn't matter. They're all alike. Yeah. You know, I don't care if it's, you know, the person on the local council or the dog man, or they're in the Senate or the House of Representatives. They're all alike. So go. People better wake up and smell the coffee. But have a good evening.
Amen. Appreciate it. Thank you, Alice. You know, and what happened to smaller, less intrusive government? What happened to less intrusive government? Jeez. But here's the thing. You know, if Vivek Ramaswamy, if he gets his way, evidently Ramaswamy is trying to out-Trump Trump. He said that he's going to cut 75% of the federal workforce and shutter several major again, as I said, you know, small enough that you can drag government into the bathtub and drown the bathtub. That's always been their goal. And who do you think they're going to go after? You know, Trump wants to do away with the Department of Education, and they've been wanting to do that for a long time. You know, where do you think, you know, Health and Human Services? Where do you think goes? Where do you think their values are? Who do you think they take out? You know, anything that's going to benefit you and your family. And I find it ironic that you know, again, trying to out-Trump Trump, given the fact that the Heritage Foundation has come up with their Project 2025 scheme, which is to bring patronage back. And a big part of that is to go and fire all the federal workers and, you know, have people who are already vetted in the pipeline. So basically what they're talking about doing, what their plot is to do what the Federalist Society has done for judges. You groom them very young, you get them into low-level jobs, and you bring them along into your ideological viewpoints. And then when the big jobs come up, you've already got them in place. They're already trained. You know everything that they're going to do before they know what to do. They want to do this for every job of the federal government. Stop and think about the level of control that they're talking about. This authoritarian mindset that you have to be faithful to dear leader and to our dear ideology, or you don't work for the federal government. And me, I keep saying I want boring bureaucrats. I want people who are competent. I want people who show up every day, do their job, and do the best job they can for we the people, without a political agenda. These folks, they want to use every lever of government for politics to move their agenda. And what's their agenda? Well, more for them and less for everybody else. So are we surprised by this? The answer, no, not even a little bit. Now, the big news today, obviously, Mitt Romney not running for another Senate term. And I find it interesting that, you know, now Romney comes out and says, look, you know, the Republicans, they don't care about the Constitution. They don't really care about any of the stuff that they throw out here. And in his exit interview, the big thing that's getting the attention right now is the tweet or the text that he sent to Mitch McConnell. Which is, you know, he evidently got a call from Angus Young. He said he spoke with people at the Pentagon. Hey, on January 6th, you know, some bad stuff's about to happen. Maybe you might want to, do something. Because, hey, Mitch, they're talking about burning your house down. Maybe you do something. McConnell never responded. And, you know, there's a moment where I go, you know, there's an opportunity for Mitch for Mitt Romney to come out and really just expose all of the insanity. And I'm hoping he does. My problem is he's going to do it in a both sides-ism way, because this is what people do these days. Trump's really bad, but we've got to figure out something for Biden too, because we don't want to make it look like we're partisan. No, when the house is on fire, you put out the fire. And right now, the fire is Donald Trump. Right now, the fire is the Republican Party, who have no agenda whatsoever. Again, I come back to this time and time again. There's nothing there. And even Romney said it. He said, do you remember when Trump said we were going to get health care and it was going to be great? It was going to be cheap. It was going to be affordable. It was going to be amazing. It was going to be the best thing ever. Do you remember that? And we never saw anything. This is what he was talking about. He said, look, they've got no agenda. The Republicans have no policies. And I love the fact that, you know, Mike Simpson, Republican from Idaho, is now saying it's going to be a giant S show, you know, as the coming days come down to the wire over the debt and the debt ceiling and the spending. And he says, look, we're in trouble. We're in big trouble because there's no leadership. And the Republican Party is off the rails because they want their pound of flesh. You've got the Scott Perrys of the world who desperately, desperately want a shutdown, because this works a couple of ways for them. It helps slow the economy. It's going to hurt the economy. It's going to get them the recession possibly that they've been, you know, having, you know, tingly feelings all over. And it's going to hurt working people. Especially federal workers, who they particularly hate. And my mind keeps going to this place. When do we finally wake up? When do we finally start throwing these bums to the curb and say, find us some people who actually care about people? Find us some folks who actually care about moving some policy that's going to make working people's lives better. Is that too much to ask? Could be. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I found out that Drew Barrymore has a talk show. I didn't know that. I thought she was a movie actress, and I always loved her movies and all that. I found out she's actually the host of a talk show, and I wish I would have found out under better circumstances, because evidently it's been a couple of years that she's been doing this. But I find out that she has this talk show because she's scabbing on the Writers Guild. And you go, why would you be doing this? Why would you want this kind of attention in this moment when all the country, all the working people, their eyes are on this? Why would you want to be the most visible, the most famous scab in the country? Makes no sense to me. But here to share some thoughts on maybe there's an answer here that I'm not getting. I've asked David Slack to come talk with us. He's a TV writer, producer, former WGA West board member, also a guy who very active on Twitter, which is how I found his thread. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick.
So walk me through this. Why?
Well, why you'd have to ask Drew Barrymore? There are a lot of things we could speculate, but it's a complicated situation because so everybody knows the WGA is on strike. Everybody knows SAG-AFTRA is on strike. But beyond that, it gets into the nuance of, how labor unions work, because SAG-AFTRA has multiple bargaining units. Talk shows, daytime talk shows, soap operas, game shows are covered under a contract called Netcode, and that contract is not on strike. So to be clear, Drew Barrymore is not scabbing against SAG-AFTRA right by going on her show right now. That contract is totally fine. The problem is her show is WGA covered. Her show, since its inception, has employed WGA writers who are currently out walking a picket line. And by going back on the air, it is very hard to believe that someone isn't performing work that was previously done by striking workers. And you know what we call a person who does work that's performed by striking workers? That's a scab. In the case of Drew Barrymore, and by the way, she's not alone. The people on The View, which is also WGA covered and has been since its inception, they've been scabbing this entire time. The Talk is about to come back. The Jennifer Hudson Show is back. Bill Maher is about to come back. So there are a lot of people in this situation. What's been so disappointing about Drew Barrymore is a couple of things. One, she's already shown a willingness to not cross our picket lines. She refused to go on to host the MTV Movie Awards early in our strike and stood in solidarity with us. So this is somebody who really showed that she was comfortable and confident in breaking contracts for the sake of the collective good, for the sake of standing in solidarity with labor. And now she's flipped on that. But she also put out a public statement that erroneously said that she wasn't breaking any WGA rules, which is just not true. It is very hard to imagine that anyone on a show that normally employs writers, and trust me, the TV show would not have writers if they didn't need them. They don't pay for anything they don't need. They try not to pay for things they do need. But so it's very hard to believe that they could, that a show that normally needs writers can be done without those writers present, without somebody scabbing on those jobs. So, and she decided to become the main character. I don't know why.
No, and this is one of those moments, I tell the story often. When my mother passed, I moved in with my grandparents, and my grandfather said, "You don't go across the street, and you don't play with that guy's grandkids. You don't go anywhere over there." And I never knew why. And I asked him a couple years later, and I said, "What was that all about?" And he said, "The guy had crossed a picket line like 40 years before. It was a railroad picket, and the entire community ostracized the guy. and the entire family. And this is where I'm looking at this moment going, as a society, we should be holding these scabs accountable in public, especially someone as high profile as Drew Barrymore. This is one of those things where the message that's being sent is all the wrong messages, and or at least I think so. I'm curious your thoughts.
I completely agree. I mean, and you can say, oh, she didn't understand, she was misinformed. That's fine. She's now been correctly informed and has a chance to make this right by stopping doing her show. You know, you can say, well, she cares about her crew and wants to put them back to work, you know, but the fact is, by going back to work with scab labor while we're still on strike, she may be putting her crew back to work, but she's providing the studios we're on strike against with content, which prolongs the strike. So her crew may be working, but every other crew in Hollywood, it might be out of work that much longer because of what she's doing. And that's really hurtful, because it's not just, you know, strikes are hard on everybody. And it's not just writers and actors on strike who are hurting. There are IATSE crew members and Teamster truck drivers and all these other businesses in LA and New York and other markets that depend on the entertainment industry. You know, the California economy is losing about $30 million a day because, you know, Bob Iger and David Zaslav and another couple of billionaire CEOs can't admit that they've already lost. Yeah. And it's time to sit down and make a deal.
No, you know, we started the show off, you know, playing the a quote from a rich guy saying, you know, we need to cause more unemployment so that, you know, those working people, you know, they get desperate again and they're back in their place. And you're part of that. I mean, the writers are part of this. You know, you've got the very wealthy who could easily afford all of your demands and all of your requests easily. It would not cost them very much at all, but it's the point. It's the point that they control you and that you should be grateful for having a job and that you should be in your place. And I see this more as that than it is about the money or about fighting over AI or any of that other stuff. Do you agree?
I think there's absolutely an element of class warfare. I think for the CEOs, I think this is like if you owned a paper mill and all of a sudden the trees started trying to tell you how many that you could pulp and turn into paper. I think it's inconceivable to them. And, you know, one thing that's tricky for us in, you know, with both actors and writers, we have some members who have done very, very well. You know, there are people who get fabulously wealthy, and Drew Barrymore is one of them. Yeah. She's worth many millions of dollars. And so the public's perception sometimes is that, well, what are you on strike for? You're all millionaires. But the fact is, we are labor. We do not decide how much we get paid. We negotiate hard over how much we get paid, but it's ultimately what the bosses will allow. And, you know, the Writers Guild of America is a middle class union. Most of our members do not make the fabulous money. We're on strike. You know, it's crazy. We struck for 100 days in 2007, 2008 to get coverage over the internet, the entire internet. Took 100 days. And if we hadn't done that, every single streaming show out there would be a non-union show, not just for writers, but for actors, for directors, for crews, for truck drivers. You know, now we're on strike for, this was day 135. So longer than it took to get the internet. And what are we on strike for? Fair pay, a cost of living raise. We had 2 years of 6% plus inflation. And these guys are trying to turn that inflation into an upside for them by limiting our pay raise and stopping us from getting basic protections against things like AI and against free rewrites. You know, it's just, it is very much an element of class warfare. You know, it is very much that at the end of the day, these guys who, you know, David Zaslav gets about $250 million a year, you know, just like two Zaslavs could cover everything the WGA is asking for 3 years. And he's already lost his company $300 to $500 million. The WGA's entire ask per year from his company is $47 million. So collectively, these guys are losing billions to maybe save millions. And you got to ask yourself, why are they doing that?
Well, I go back to what I said a moment ago. It's all about control. It's all about, we're going to keep you in your place and you're going to do what you're told and you're going to be happy about it.
Yeah. And it sure as hell looks to me like they're violating their fiduciary duty to their shareholders over this stuff. And, you know, you look at some of the companies we're on strike against are Netflix, Apple, Amazon, you know, we've got tech companies. And for them, I think they don't want their other employees to know that a union can beat them. Because that's, you know, if we beat them, how's that look to Amazon warehouse workers or the people who work at Apple stores or the coders at Netflix All of these are, you know, largely non-union jobs that are ripe for unionization and in the most positive environment for labor organizing that we've seen, you know, in maybe 60 years. So, you know, I think they very much want us to lose. But the fact is, we're 135 days into this and our solidarity is rock solid. We had a picket of showrunners. Those are, you know, the writers who run television shows, who generally do very well. And there's not actually much at stake for a lot of them in this negotiation. We had, I think, about 400 show up at the Fox lot. It was so crowded, you could barely walk. And they donated collectively in various forms with gift cards and Venmo and stuff. They donated about $40,000 to help our members get through this. So our solidarity is unbroken. It's just time for them to sit down and make a deal. And, you know, the only reason I think that they won't is they can't get on the same page with each other because they're competitors. And I think it just rankles. I think they just don't want to accept that a little union of ordinary people could bring them to their knees.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about an old timer I knew years ago who said, you know, every 10 years he used to take his union on strike just because it built this solidarity, just because it built relationships with other unions and showed working people that they could fight for something and win something. And once you grab onto it, once you win something, you never give it up. And that was the, you know, that's what I'm seeing happening as all of these, you know, the Teamsters with the UPS, the UAW going on right now, you guys out there, it's this sense of we're fighting the good fight. We're fighting for tomorrow. And that's got to scare the you know what out of some.
Oh, it should. They should be really scared. I mean, one of my personal heroes is Sarah Nelson, who's the head of the Association of Flight Attendants. And she says this wonderful thing: using power builds power.
Yep.
When we use our power, when we recognize our own power and use it, when we stand together, we actually get stronger. And, you know, the WGA, there's 11,500 of us, you know, we're not necessarily the most physically intimidating crowd, although some of us are, you know, but, you know, you like, you look at the Teamsters and it's a different vibe, right? But we have organized ourselves. We held together through a 2.5 year campaign to renegotiate the way that our agents were doing business. We changed their business practices. We got them to give up a conflicted business practice. And we actually got two private equity firms signed to union deals, which I'm not sure has happened before. Wow. And then we used that power. We had to renegotiate our last contract in 2020 in May, in the height of the pandemic. So our leverage is gone, right? Like, what are we going to do? Go on strike? Everything's shut down. But because of the power that we had built by how we dealt with the agencies and how we held together, then we were able to get the money we needed into our pension plan and win a portable paid parental leave benefit that lets our members take paid parental leave regardless of which studio they're working for at the time, with no leverage, with, you know, what were we going to do? Strike? But we still got it. So using power builds power, and recognizing your power and talking to your other members about it is so essential.
Let me ask you this, David, because, you know, one of the things that I've been saying about what you and the SAG-AFTRA folks are striking for, and I've been saying this is the first battle in the AI war, in the tech war. This is the first, really the first battle in this war that the reason that all of us should be concerned about what happens to you, and why I've been calling for people to adopt a striker when they find a picket line, go walk with someone, bring, you know, water, bring a pizza, you know, drop a couple bucks in the donation bin, help how you can, but most certainly get involved. But this matters to all of us, because if you're unable to stop what we see coming, the rest of us are, I think, doomed. Do you see it kind of the same way?
Yeah, no, I mean, AI is an interesting issue for us, because I thought it was going to be like something we just needed to square away, because our contract has said for years that a writer is a person. So I thought this was pro forma, and it was surprising to a lot of us when our negotiating partners in the AMPTP said, well, we're not going to make any sort of deal on that because we don't want to rule out a technology we may want to use someday. And that was rather shocking to us. There's not much that they can do with it now. There's some, you know, contractual loophole things they could use it, but ChatGPT is not ready to do what I do. And I frankly think that it'll be able to do a CEO's job a long time before it can do mine. That's just an optimization algorithm. If mine, you have to understand the human soul and the human experience. You know, a chat algorithm can't write about its mother dying because it never had one. Now, with SAG-AFTRA, though, with the actors, this is already existential for them. They're already having background people get paid one day's wages to get a full body scan so that they can use them as digital background in perpetuity throughout the universe and all media now existing or hereafter devised. A friend of mine who's an audiobook narrator has already had her voice stolen twice by two separate AI companies. And when she tries to make claims on that, they're like, you can't copyright your own voice. And I think you're absolutely right, though, that these are, you know, oh, that just concerns you. But the fact is, this is coming for all of us. It's coming for lawyers. It's coming for doctors. It's certainly coming for CPAs. You know, anything that is knowledge work is suddenly vulnerable. And it's not enormously different, by the way, than the mechanization, the automation of auto factories, you know, 40 years ago. So I think we're at a point where we as a society are going to have to choose between two possible futures. One in which humans have jobs and we have a reason to get out of bed in the morning and something to feel proud about and a way to make money and support ourselves and our family and our society functions. Or another future where two or three people have an enormous amount of money. The rest of us are on some sort of universal basic income or welfare. And we have a bloody revolution every 10 to 15 years. And that changes who the two or three people with all the money are. I know which one I want. I think there's two or three people out there who think they might get to be the lucky guy with all the money. But I think we fundamentally have to choose. And I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of those other crafts and trades that AI is coming for aren't unionized. So, you know, when they come for lawmakers, I think we'll get some legislation pretty quickly.
Well, there you go. Last question I've got for you. How can folks help? What can we do? Because, look, this has gone on far too long already. You know, how can we put pressure on the Drew Barrymores of the world to not scab? And you listed a number of other folks. How do we put pressure on them? What's the marching order?
Well, I mean, thank you so much for asking. I love the adopt a striker. It's certainly putting pressure on people who are scabbing Drew Barrymore, the cast of The View, you know, shows like The Talk. Just to be clear, news programs, different contract. That's not WGA, and The View is not a news program. If anybody has questions about what shows are and aren't covered, they can go direct to directories.wga.org, and you type in the show title, and you'll see if it's WGA covered. But as far as other ways to help, there are some great resources here. And as I said, it's not just writers and actors who are feeling this. It's everybody in our industry. So there's something called the Entertainment Community Fund. That's at entertainmentcommunityfund.org. And people can go there and donate. And they are providing enormous amounts of support, both financial and services. Like, they'll help people find healthcare. If their healthcare expires, there's psychological counseling, there's financial counseling. So the Entertainment Community Fund is one that I would, you know, definitely recommend. There's also a wonderful person who's a longtime friend of mine named Joelle Garfinkel, who you can find on Twitter, Joelle Garfinkel. She's doing something called Green Envelope Groceries. That's a mutual aid thing. She's taken in $175,000 in donations so far and redistributed them at no cost to people who are affected by the strike to help them just keep food on the table. So, but yeah, spread the word, let people know that, you know, this is important, and, you know, scabbing makes it all take longer. And like you said, it's already gone on too long. I really appreciate it.
I hope folks will help out because the more people we can get involved, the more people who get out on that picket line, the more people who are donating, the shorter this strike will be. But David, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
I'd love that. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, David Slack. I got to tell you, this is another one of those moments where you just go, if all of us just came together, get out on those picket lines, this kind of stuff wouldn't have to happen all like this. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that the state police stormed Attica Correctional Facility in New York. 4 days earlier, the inmates had taken over the prison. One guard was killed. The guards were members of AFSCME Council 82. The prisoners demanded improvements to their brutal living conditions in the overcrowded prison. Police retook most of the prison, but the inmates held guards hostage in cell block D. One of the prisoners, Elliot James Barkley, explained the takeover. "We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not depend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disrespect for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States." When the police stormed the prison, they dropped tear gas from helicopters. They fired 3,000 rounds, firing on prisoners and hostages indiscriminately. They killed 29 inmates and 10 hostages. Police claimed the prisoners had killed the hostages. They also accused the inmates of committing atrocities against the guards. Public outrage swelled against the inmates, including racially charged hate directed at the black prisoners. But autopsies proved that all of those killed had been felled by police bullets. Attica became the rallying cry for those concerned about prison conditions. It has been referenced by many in movies and songs, including John Lennon's Attica State. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, I gotta tell you, I'm not a Swiftie. I love some of the stuff she's done. I've never really gotten into the music as much. I've seen her in concert once. Took my wife years ago to see Taylor Swift when we were in Cleveland. But I gotta tell you, I love who she is. Taking on Ticketmaster, and now this story coming out of, this is how it should be. She has the Eras Tour film coming out, and she bypassed the big studios. In fact, as it's been called a giant middle finger to the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, because Taylor Swift said, "You know what? I'm not going to go through the major studios. I'm going to self-distribute this, to AMC and distribute it ourselves." So she went to SAG-AFTRA and said, "Hey, folks, want a contract?" And basically gave them everything that they needed. And there will be this film coming out. And it's this is the kind of person that, I got to tell you, I thought Drew Barrymore was. This is not a person who needs the money. It's my view that these shows, with these extraordinarily well-paid hosts should be paying their staff to keep them around. During this strike should be helping them. And there are some, there are a number that are doing that. But to have someone, say, "You know what, we're gonna screw you." I'm gonna say this right now. I will never watch a Drew Barrymore show. And this is where, as a society, you need to turn away from these people. Because understand, while it's in our media structure, it's framed as, these writers, they're making all this money, they're wealthy, they just want more, they're greedy. You hear this about unions all the time. They're just greedy, they just want more. Without actually understanding that when they do better, we all do better. When they get better wages, hours, conditions, it trickles down to everyone else. You go back to the good old days, the heyday of the labor movement, back in the 60s when 35% of the private sector workforce was unionized. 35% of the other side, the non-union sector, made virtually the same wages, hours, conditions, because they didn't want the union to come into those places. So everyone did better. And what's happened since then? As we've, thank you, Ronald Reagan, firing the Patco workers, sending the shot across the boardroom that it was open season on unions and workers. What's happened since that moment? We've seen a deadlining of wages. We've seen conditions get worse. We've seen health care be taken away. We've seen defined benefit pensions totally eviscerated. And families struggling. The anger out there is real. And as I keep saying, the way forward are these strikes, which is why people should, as I've been calling for, adopt a striker. Reach out, walk with them, hear their stories, help support their families. Because again, I should have asked David about this. Out of this strike came the comment from an executive that this will go on as long as until people start losing their homes. And people, until they start getting kicked out of their apartments. So for me, this idea of, maybe we start breaking up some of these big conglomerates. Maybe they're too big to exist when they have this kind of outweighed power to do, as David said, lose billions of dollars just to save millions. And it's not about the money. It's about the point. It's about keeping people under their thumb, staying in control. Making those working people desperate and in their place.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, the fact that we have chosen through our government to more than double childhood poverty is a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. And look, we need to hold those accountable who push for this. And I keep coming back to, we know who they are. There are Republican colleagues. There are the folks who, we want government so small we can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. There should be no social safety net. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, especially you kids. And if you're hungry enough and desperate enough, maybe we can get you a job in the meatpacking plant, cleaning the saw blades. That's where we're heading because of the people that we've put into power. It's disgraceful. But here to share some thoughts on maybe how we got here and why we're here, I've asked Amy Hanauer to come talk with us. Amy is the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP.org, the website. Amy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, nice to be here, Rick.
So walk me through these numbers. I mean, I saw these numbers yesterday from the Census Bureau, and it to me just infuriated me and disgraceful. How'd we get here?
Yeah, well, here's the deal. In 2021, we decided to expand the child tax credit and put out the stimulus checks and do some little expansions to the earned income tax credit because we knew that unemployment was going to be spiking, that people were struggling, that the economy was going through a really rough period. And lo and behold, we managed to cut child poverty in half that year. We brought child poverty to the lowest rate that had ever been recorded, 5.2%. And it was just like, despite the fact that lots of parents were unemployed and lots of people were really struggling, lots of people had their hours cut, we had the lowest child poverty numbers on record. But at the end of that period, in late 2021, we couldn't get our policymakers to agree to keep that policy in place. And so as a result, we cut back the child tax credit to its previous level, and we just got the numbers for 2022. And it turns out that child poverty more than doubled compared to 2021. It increased by the highest rate ever recorded. And it's basically where it was, back in 2018 and 2019, back up around 12.5%. So we kind of saw that it's a policy choice to have higher rates of child poverty, that we had this simple policy, we put it in place, and it did the trick. even in the roughest economy that we'd seen in a long time.
And what was the, you know, because as I remember, it was an extra $250 a month for kids over six, $300 a month for kids under six, which doesn't sound like an awful lot of money. But when you start and you think about the fact that, you know, minimum wage is still $7.25, that kind of help, you know, I can see why it did what it did. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. I mean, over the course of the year, the maximum amount would have increased was instead of being $2,000 per kid, it would have been $3,600 for little kids under the age of five, or five and younger, I should say, and $3,000 for age kids age six and older. And so it was just like, you know, over the course of the year, it was enough extra money that, you know, that you could afford kind of the basics. And that's, in fact, what people spent it on. You know, there have been some analyses and like people spent it on food. They spent it on clothing. They spent it on school supplies. They paid their utility bills and they covered the rent with it. And, you know, that was what it was spent on. And it helped all families, right? It helped a lot of working class and middle class families, but it's especially meaningful if you're really struggling to make ends meet and you get an extra $3,600. You know, that really is meaningful.
You know, I when this happened, and I remember it vividly when it went away, and I remember talking about the cruelty of taking this away. Because, you know, I, as I've talked about on the show before, I grew up in a housing project. My mother was on and off welfare a number of times through my childhood because, you know, the 70s were not a great time for single mothers. They were the last hired, first fired. And, you know, just to make ends meet, sometimes you had to go on welfare and get help. And it never lasted till the end of the month. And I opined on this idea of, you know, what an extra, you know, $50 or $100 a month would have meant to her and ultimately to our family during that period. And then I said, you know, look, you know, giving it to us and saying that, hey, we're going to help and there's going to be a better possibility, and then yanking it away, that seems incredibly cruel. So having had this program to let kids know that, you know, someone did care about them for a little bit and their lives got a little bit better, and then to have it ripped away like this, that just seems cruel to me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, we couldn't get any of the Republicans to get behind it. And I think in the end, Senator Joe Manchin was skeptical and he wanted work requirements. And there's a lot of like, you know, debate that like people are going to not work because they're getting a couple $1,000 a year to help them raise their kids. And that was another thing that's really been disproven by the research. Like when they talk to people, not only did people say, no, like that's not enough money to like quit my job over, but like to the contrary, a lot of people said, actually, this helped me go to work, right? Because it meant that I knew I could put my kids in a safer place and, you know, I could pay the neighbor a couple bucks extra to watch my kids or whatever it was. So there's been no evidence that it disrupted parental employment, but it was enough to give people childcare and help them or give people the time to finish school. So I think you're absolutely right. It's really kind of a cruelty to say we're the richest country on the planet. We're richer than we've ever been. We're willing to give huge subsidies to corporations, huge corporate tax breaks, but we're not willing to do this thing that helps families kind of make ends meet.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Amy Hanauer. Amy is the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. You can check out their website, itep.org, ITEP.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can check out the work that they do. So now that we've laid this out and we know how bad this policy choice was, that we've chosen to more than double childhood poverty, we've chosen to more than double the number of children who are going to go to bed hungry, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that can be done. First of all, you know, a lot of people are like using this as a clear bargaining chip. Anytime that the Republicans want any kind of corporate tax break, we're going to say, no way should there be a corporate tax break unless we get the child tax credit restored. And that was a fight that we had again at the end of 2022. And, you know, we didn't get the child tax credit restored, but we did manage to get them to not be able to pass another big corporate tax break. So that was like a partial victory in that way. I think the other thing is that states can take up the mantle, and a lot of states are doing so. I got a couple numbers for you, but, you know, states can pass their own earned income tax credits and they can pass their own child tax credits. And 14 states now have a child tax credit. There are new ones, a whole bunch of new ones passed this year. They're larger than ever before. There are 5 states, Colorado, Minnesota, New Jersey, Oregon, Vermont, that are giving refundable child tax credits of above $1,000 per kid. So this is another way that states can kind of say, look, if the federal government's not going to do this, we want to step up. And I think that's part of it. But, you know, we got to hold our senators and members of Congress accountable. It's ridiculous. As you said, it's cruel. And look, we've got a bunch of business tax breaks that they are just only too happy to hand over. Yeah. And this is a more important policy.
Yeah. How much did this program, because I say we could end childhood hunger. We could we quite easily could. I'm sure some corporate tax breaks being rescinded could help with that. Maybe, I don't know, a billionaire's tax could help part of it. But how much was this? How much did we save by having more hungry children? In fact, almost 60% more. How much did we save in this?
Yeah, I mean, and save is a funny word, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But I mean, the credit as we have it right now costs about $125 billion. And having the more generous benefit in place. So we have a child tax credit, right? We do provide a child tax credit, and it's good, and it pulls people out of poverty and it helps families. Having the more generous benefit in place that cut child poverty down to historic lows would have cost about $100 billion more. And so, that's not nothing, right? But what's important to remember is we have these business tax breaks that the Republicans are clamoring to have in place. Accelerated depreciation that costs $67 billion for just the top 25 corporations that use it the most, right? We've got research expensing. We've got loose limits on interest deductions. I mean, we've got expanded small business expensing. We've got these overseas tax breaks. I mean, we just have tax break after tax break for these large corporations. We've got tons of multinational corporations stowing their profits overseas and hiding them from the American government. So, the question is, where do you want to put those tax breaks? And then I'll just say one more thing, because you were saying, what do we save? It's not really savings at all, right? Because when kids are going to bed hungry, they're not going to be able to thrive in school. They're not going to be able to learn much. They're going to be less able to graduate. They're going to be less able to get a good job when they're out of school. So we end up paying in the long run because we're too cheap in the short run, even though we have the money in this really wealthy country.
No, you're right. We used to understand, what was it, penny wise and pound foolish? Wasn't that the saying?
Right.
And this is one of those things. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because ultimately, I hope this embarrassment is something that makes our elected leaders move to action. Although I'm sure my Republican friends don't seem to care because it doesn't appear to faze them. What should we be doing to push to get something done? What should folks be doing and what should we be demanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think that absolutely it's like, pushing your member of Congress, pushing your senator, and just saying, restore the full child tax credit. I mean, it's as simple as that. Restore the full child tax credit, cut poverty in half. So it's as simple as that at the federal level. And at the state level, demand, I don't know if you've got audience members in every state, but demand that your state add a state child tax credit. That's another way of taking this on. And look, in states, most of our tax codes in states are upside down, where you got low-income families paying a higher share of their income in taxes than the wealthiest families are paying. And you got middle-income families paying a higher share than the wealthiest families are paying. So there's plenty of money in states to take this on. We got plenty of corporate tax breaks in states too. So there's there's plenty of ways that people could be taking this on. But the simple message is restore the full child tax credit and cut child poverty back in half.
There you go. But again, it comes down to our priorities, our values. Show me a budget and I'll show you your values. Amy, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, always great to talk to you, Rick. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, our good friend Amy Hanauer. Make sure you check out their website, itep.org, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, itep.org. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Got the time.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Got an email from Taylor saying, podcast listener here, so I'm a day behind the show. Your segment on child poverty, your personal experience with it really moved me. You're right in saying that the pro-lifers aren't really pro-life, as they only care about fetuses and nothing after that. To make that more clear, I think you should start referring to them as forced birthers, as it's clearly defined what their ideology is all about. Love the show. Appreciate it, Taylor. And look, you know, at the end of this, I'm not wrong. They don't seem to give a rat's behind about these kids going hungry. And it should make us just downright angry. I mean, seriously, the things that... let's go to the phones. Got Steve on line one. Steve, how are you?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I think it's such an important topic because, as you've already alluded to, these are people who are basically saying, that, okay, we want to have a thriving, vibrant workforce. We're Americans and America first. And, you know, they've sold themselves as the party and the interest that is America first. But on the other hand, nothing about their public policy interest would indicate that. Well, Americans want to be able to feed their children, send them to decent schools, provide them with a college education. Yet the Republican Party is for none of this. They don't want to help you at any point along this process, except when it comes to the case of mandating that you have a child that you may or may not want to have. So, and it's always amused me because at some point you are going to have to pay for this sooner or later. We know that there's a correlation between what we spend on children in terms of their early development, in terms of their education, and how much money you're going to spend down the road in terms of welfare, unemployment benefits, how much you're going to have to spend on the prison industrial system, all of that. So if you can spend a dollar now that saves you $100 down the road, wouldn't you want to do that? But we live in a society, unfortunately, where it's this: as long as I'm taken care of and mine are taken care of, and then if I live in a neighborhood and my neighbors and I want to come together and spend a lot of money because we all live in very nice homes and pay for a nice educational system that's predicated upon the value of our homes, which is how we fund education in this country, then that's fine. But there will be no statewide educational program, with the exception of some states that do have things like state income tax and a state program for primary and secondary educational funding. But there is no national educational funding. Local school districts get about 10 to 12% of their funding from the national government in terms of how we fund education. So make no mistake, with the quality of education your kids get, is dependent upon what kind of home you can afford and your neighbors can afford, yeah, and how much they're willing to pay in taxes to help educate children. And is that any way for society to exist moving forward in a global economy, which is going to demand more and more of those kids be cognitively developed at an earlier age, ready to compete in a global workforce. I mean, I don't know where these people think they're going to make that money that they're hoping to save by not contributing to the greater good down the road, because it's going to come back to bite them sooner or later. When we can't compete on the global stage anymore, what's going to happen? And I'll answer my own question in that regard. You know, the only people that many Republicans expect to be patriotic are people who have very little. When it comes to the uber wealthy, no, there's nothing patriotic about their money. Their money is all over the place globally. You know, so they have no particular allegiance to this country except for the degree to which this country can protect their interests.
Yep.
So if they have intellectual property rights, yeah, we need the Justice Department to keep China from ripping off the thing that, you know, the company that I've invested in has created. Then we need the U.S. government. But if I need to pay taxes to that government, I'm going to hide my money in various other places because I don't want to do that part of it. So, you know, I mean, again, it's just amazing that people continue to vote Republican in this country, thinking that somehow that they are the party of patriotism and what defines a true American.
No, I'm right there with you. But ultimately, don't you think it comes down to the fact that, you know, we're not going to help those people? And we know who the image of those people are. But the reality is, you know, there are a lot more broke, poor white people, especially in red states that have the highest poverty rates. They're the ones suffering. And look, as someone who lives in a northern state who pays a higher tax rate than most, and a state that pays more into the federal government than they get back, you know, I'm okay with that because I don't want children to go hungry.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because you raise a great point there. You know, the image that we have of the welfare queen, you know, and what, you know, people like Matt Gaetz call the couch potato and so forth, you know, that is a person of color. And so that when you look at societies that are more willing to help, it turns out that Northern Europe, which, you know, is much more social democratic, what we call democratic socialist in this country. Well, when you're a homogeneous society, you know, it's easy for Norwegians to say, yeah, I'm willing to help a lot of other Norwegians who have less than I do because they look like I do.
Right.
But when it comes to a heterogeneous society such as this, turns out that a lot of people who are middle class, upper middle class, and so forth, especially older people, they look at the people who need, and they don't see anyone who looks like them. They're misguided in that regard because the vast majority of people who are in need look like them. And by the way, the people who tend to need for about 2 years before they re-enter the workforce, before they can go off of welfare, as it were. This idea that people spend decades on welfare, yes, there are a handful that do so. The vast majority of people who need help in this country do not stay on welfare for years. It's less than 2 years, and then they're back there working in the workforce just like everybody else. A majority of the people who receive aid in this country are working people, because you do still get to qualify for some aid if you don't make enough money.
Yep.
And so, you know, we've got all of these images of people sitting around wearing designer clothing, playing video games, and watching expensive cable television while everybody else works, and they just lead the life of Riley. And that is not what's going on in America.
Well, no, I grew up in a housing project. I know that's not reality. But Steve, I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, I mean, you know, the reality is, and Steve makes an interesting point. You know, the patriotic, the patriotism for the poor. You know, we send them off to fight and die in wars, all of that. But when we start talking about taxing rich people, what's the first thing they say? Well, they'll just move. They'll move out of the state. They'll move out of the country. They'll take their money and they'll run. And this, again, is another one of these weird moments where, as working people, we should be coalescing around the idea. And I don't care which party, you know, find me someone who's going to help working people. Find someone who's going to ensure that my work is compensated fairly. You know, it's interesting that Steve brings up the fact that, you know, the majority of people who collect food stamps and get government assistance actually have jobs. One of the biggest welfare queens in the country is Walmart, because, you know, their employees, lots of public benefits, because they don't pay enough. I've often said I want to make sure that everyone has a job. I'm not against work requirements. I'm against work requirements that don't have any work. So for me, if you have a program where government is the employer of last resort, where if you know, in my neighborhood where I grew up, we weren't on the bus line. There weren't jobs within walking distance. It's the government who should step in and fill that void and create the competition to make sure that wages can support a family, to make sure that wages can put food on the table, a roof over the head, and have health care when people get sick, and some retirement security when they get old. The question is, what kind of a society do we want? Do we want the society as we've been talking about for years? I mean, you know, you go back to John Edwards and the two Americas, the haves and the have-nots. Do we want that? Is that the future that we want? Or do we want to have a future where you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead? I know where I want to be. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the hours are ticking down to a potential strike with the UAW and the Big Three. And look, this is, you know, in my view, I think it's probably going to happen because I don't know that the Big Three are ready to meet the demands of the workers at this moment. Hope I'm wrong. But you look at the massive profits of these big companies and you just go, at some point, they've got to share some of it. But this didn't just happen. This has been decades of assaults on workers in this industry. And I had a bunch of emails yesterday, of folks saying, look, you know, I worked at the Flint plant back in the 80s and this happened. And I remember the Reagan high dollar policies that made Japanese imports much cheaper that crushed our industry and on and on and on. And the assault on these workers over the years, it's finally built to a head to where they're saying no more. And that's why I've asked Scott Holderson to come talk with us. Scott is the UAWD Steering Committee Chairperson. He's also a former Vice President of UAW Local 551. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rick. I really love the show and happy to talk about the UAW and what's been going on.
Now, you know, as I said here a second ago, the fact that I think you're at a boiling point right now of decades of attacks on your members, decades of concessionary contracts and two-tiered wage systems and all of these things that have just been, well, basically shoved down your throat. I think you're at a breaking point. Am I assessing this properly?
Yeah, I'd say you're assessing it very well. We've been taking decades of concessions, and they really went into high gear in the last 20 years. And you know, we're ready to fight to get back what was stolen from us by these companies.
Now you've been a UAW member how many years?
34 years.
And over your lifespan, things getting better, getting worse. How much worse, if that's the case? Walk me through the last 34 years.
Well, it's been concessionary contract after concessionary contract, but things really went into high gear back in 2007. Before the bankruptcies, the UAW agreed to a two-tier wage and benefit structure. And, in my estimation at the time, that was the dumbest concession that we could have possibly made because these companies were facing bankruptcy. We all knew it. But when you're facing bankruptcy, you're not hiring anyone. So a two-tier wage and benefit structure does nothing to keep you from going into bankruptcy. So that was one of the worst of the concessions back in 2007. And, then in 2009, they took away some of our bonuses and pay increases that were in the contract. They took away our cost of living allowance, which at the time was 99 cents an hour. And that was basically a dollar an hour wage cut. Since then, our wages have been stagnating with inflation going through the roof. Since 2005, we've had 2-3% wage increases. That's it.
Wow. So basically what you're earning today is what you were earning 34 years ago.
Yeah. Well, not 34 years ago, but 20 years ago.
No, because this is one of those things. I remember when I first entered, we're probably about the same age. When I entered the workforce, those auto worker jobs, those were the gold standard. Those were solid upper middle class jobs with good wages. There was hard work. The assembly line work is not easy. You busted your behind, but the wages, the benefits, all of that stuff were top tier. And now, I'm looking at the wages, $17 an hour at the low end, $32 at the top end. That's not.
Yeah, we've obviously lost a lot of ground. When I started in 1989, the starting wage was $12 and some change. In 34 years, it's only gone up. The starting wage has only gone up about $4 an hour.
And there's no economic gimmickry there. That's dollar for dollar.
That's dollar for dollar. Yeah. That's not including, inflation rate or any of that. Workers now are starting at 16 and some change. I was starting at 20 and some change. Or I'm sorry, 12 and some change. And, that's 34 years ago. And that was the starting rate. It took me 18 months to get to top pay. Now workers are starting as temporary workers, being in precarious, basically a probationary status for years on end. And then when they finally get seniority, their time starts then, not when they first got hired. And then they have an 8-year progression.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing that we're fighting against right now to reverse. And, President Sean Fain is really laying it all on the table. This contract negotiation is different than anything I've ever witnessed in the UAW. And, as I said, I'm a UAW member for 34 years.
And good on them. Now, what's getting the attention, and every time I hear Sean Fain's name, it's always the union boss is demanding these outrageous, these outrageous demands, 46% pay increase and 32-hour work week. I got to tell you, having listened to what you just laid out, 46% increase doesn't sound anywhere near enough.
No, I mean, you consider that, contracts, in the past had like 3% wage increases every year. By not having those wage increases for the past 15 years at least, 20 years, 3% over 20 years is 60%.
Right. Now, where did the 46% number come from?
I'm not sure where the 46% came from, but I know the 40% is what it's been kind of rounded to, and that's the increase that the CEOs of these companies have gotten over the past 4 years.
Right. That's what was my understanding. The 46% number came out of, that's what the executives pocketed over the last 4 years. So it's simply saying, look, you gave yourself this. How about paying the people who actually get down on the shop floor, sweating their you-know-whats off, busting their knuckles, doing the hard work? How about we help them?
Well, and we're the source of their profits. You know, if it weren't for the work that we do, there would be no profits. So, you know, that's the whole, you know, the whole rub of the situation is that, you know, we've been left behind. We've made these immense profits for these companies, and it's time for us to get our fair share.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things that I just learned, and because we heard a lot about, you know, I've got right-wing friends who think, you know, when the bankruptcy happened, you know, Obama bailed you guys out and you guys got a sweetheart deal and all of this stuff. And I said, look, the reason people are ticked off about what happened during that period is you guys didn't lose your pensions like everyone else had in the past. And maybe this was a good way to start for the future to make sure workers don't take it on the chin every time a company bankrupts itself. But you guys took a beating during that, during that bankruptcy that I don't think enough people understand the concessions you took, the pain, the suffering that workers took through that. And now they're wildly profitable. I saw, what was it? You know, $250 billion in profit over the last couple of years. You go, hey, when times were tough, you came to us with your hand out going, give us back. But now that the times are fat and happy, we can't share. There's something just unfair. There's something wrong with that, I think.
Yeah. And, in addition to, giving up wage increases and bonuses, in those bankruptcy years, we gave up a very important thing that was cost of living allowance. And, that allowed our wages to keep up with inflation. And by not having that, it was actually termed as suspended until the companies got back on their feet. Well, in my estimation, they've been back on their feet for well over a decade. They've made $250 billion in the last decade. And, President Fain put it so succinctly when he said what $250 billion is. It's hard to wrap your head around that number. It's just, an astronomical number. But you could have bought every Major League Baseball team, every National Hockey League team, and every National Basketball Association team, and then still had $50 billion left over to buy season tickets for every season ticket holder.
I mean, that's an obscene amount of money. I mean, it really is. And this is another one of these moments where you look and you go, where did it go? You guys go, you do the work, you create this wealth, this profit, and then it's divvied up against our board of directors, our CEOs, and the shareholders. When does it trickle down?
Tonight, President Fain had a Facebook Live presentation, and it showed that the stock buybacks and the dividends to shareholders had increased over the last 4 years by 1,500%. That's where all the money went. It went back to shareholders and dividends. CEO pay only went up, 40%. UAW workers pay went up 6% in the last 4 years. So, all the money is going to the top, and that's what's causing the imbalance in the wealth distribution in our country and in the world for that matter. But definitely, in our country, we've seen the distribution of wealth go to the very few at the very top, and everybody else is getting left behind. So we are fighting turn that around and get the workers their fair share, not only here, but this is going to raise the standard for workers across the country. At least that's our hope.
And the other important part of this, and this is where, again, I think unions need to really start focusing on the next generation of jobs. One of the demands is, as EVs come online, that those jobs are UAW jobs, and we we streamline into that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, that's an existential threat to the union. You know, what they're trying to do is have these joint ventures for battery plants, and through that exclude the workers that are making the internal combustion engines that have made these incredible profits over the last 10 years, and just leave them by the sidelines. You know, when throw them away when they're done with them, as they've done with, you know, with union workers for the past 20 years. In the past 20 years, they've closed, these three companies have closed 65 plants. Those are 65 communities that are suffering because of the loss of jobs, the loss of tax base, families being separated, families having to uproot and move across the country to be able to keep their jobs, but leave behind the little league and the churches and the schools. You know, it's just devastating to the communities across this country. And these corporations, they just don't care.
I'm right there with you. What do you say to the person, Scott, who says, it's just too much? You know, 32-hour work week, 46% increase in wages, you know, defined benefit pension for all workers. You know, just way too much. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that, you know, these companies could afford that, you know, in their heyday in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. We had all of that. When we went to a four-day work week schedule, we still had overtime after 8 hours. What's four times eight? That's 32. That's a 32-hour work week. We're just asking for what we had before.
Right.
And, you know, with the 40%, we've lost 60% of, you know, in wage increases that we should have gotten over the last 20 years. So, you know, we're not asking for the moon here. We're just asking to have a lifestyle that used to be called the American dream, right? Where you could raise your family, have a little extra money for some leisure activities. We're not asking to get rich. We're not asking to be wealthy. The CEOs are making $20 to $29 million a year. We don't want that in our lifetime.
Yeah, that's crazy. The hours are ticking down. Any prediction? Do we think that that a strike is imminent? Are you hearing anything positive that might give you hope that a strike can be averted? What are your thoughts?
Well, the companies have been moving a little closer, but they're still not close enough. There's still, you know, a little more than 24 hours left. And, you know, if the companies are serious about maintaining their profits that we've been making for them, then they'll open those pocketbooks up and you know, come across with a deal that makes our members whole. We're not asking for anything, you know, outrageous. We're asking for the standard of living that auto workers had before these companies used the economic crisis to come after us and try and break the American dream.
I got to tell you, I wish you guys the best. I hope a strike can be averted, but ultimately, if it has to happen, I wish you one day longer, one day stronger. I hope you'll come back and share with us as this continues down the road. I'd love to have you keep us up to date on what's going on.
Yep. Glad to be here and love your show and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. Scott Holdson. Make sure you check out their website, UAWD.org. Unite All Workers for Democracy is what that stands for. He's part of the steering committee there. Also, he was a former UAW Vice President, Local 551. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2013. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to clear out Zocalo Square in Mexico City. The square was occupied by protesting teachers. The teachers had been on strike for weeks. They wanted changes made to educational reforms that had been passed by the Mexican government. The education reforms included new performance-related testing for teachers. But the reforms did little to address the economic disparity faced by many school children. The evaluation tests did not take into account the difficult conditions for teachers in the poorest regions of Mexico. The teachers worried the tests would lead to mass layoffs. Police wanted to clear Zocalo Square before Mexico's annual independence celebration. Most protesters left peacefully. However, some remained. Police, using armored vehicles and helicopters, clashed with the remaining protesters. Officers tore down protesters' temporary shelters and put out small bonfires. Protesters responded by throwing projectiles at the police. The police arrested many of the remaining protesting teachers. After the square was cleared, a BBC reporter noted that police had achieved their goal. Still, the reporter added, "The sight of riot police and armored vehicles in the country's most emblematic plaza is not the image of unity the government wanted to portray hours before President Peña Nieto celebrated his first Independence Day as Mexico's president." If it sounds familiar, it is, because teachers in the United States are dealing with similar issues. Teachers, through their unions, in both the United States and Mexico, fight for a quality education for all children.
We don't need no education.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. I don't do enough pitching the podcast, and I really should. If you miss any, grab it, share with your friends, all of that stuff as well. A couple of emails I want to jump into. Terry in Santa Fe sent me one that reminded me of, you know, in looking at the auto industry, what's happened over the last, you know, 40, 50 years. The Reagan era was horrible for the auto industry. Because ultimately, look, you know, the Reagan high dollar policy was horribly destructive to manufacturing in the U.S. And the auto industry took it, you know, just probably harder than anyone. Well, maybe the steel industry. But, you know, you look at the fact that they went after, just... In enormous ways, working people. And again, it started with the shot heard across the boardroom firing the Patco workers. But the global high dollar policy, this idea that, the dollar was, we got to have a strong dollar, which meant the Japanese could well devalue their currency, which meant Japanese cars were dirt cheap here in the U.S. And look. When people have the option of going, hey, I can buy something cheap and small, since the big three weren't making small cars, it was harmful. And that assault on manufacturing during the Reagan years, this move towards a service-based economy. And I remember, and she reminded me of that time period, because I remember being told, those dirty factory jobs are going to all go. We don't need those jobs. We don't need those industries. We're all going to have corner offices. We're all going to wear white shirts and ties. And it's going to be the service-based economy, the knowledge economy. And I remember going through high school, people saying, well, you don't need, machine shop or any of that stuff. All that stuff's going to be done overseas. And look, we had machine shop and wood shop and, all that stuff. And I'm very fortunate for that, because I learned an awful lot. But what happened over the years since, they wiped all that stuff out because Reagan's vision came to fruition. And it wasn't Reagan's. I give him way too much credit. It was the people who owned him, the Business Roundtable. Our corporate titans. Our million-dollar, $23 million, $29 million CEOs, who it's all about the bottom line. And back to where we started. It's all about having workers in their place. Just be glad you got a job. Just be happy you have a job. Even if it doesn't pay like it used to. And look, I look at the auto worker jobs, and I guess it's one of those special ones for me, because the first time I saw someone get a union job, I was like eight years old, and it was a UAW job. It was a neighbor got a job at Ford, and immediately their lives got better and quickly. Food at the end of the month. Kids got secondhand bikes. They got a secondhand car. They eventually moved out of the neighborhood altogether. Very quickly, their lives got enormously better. And that stuck with me for years. And now to see that those jobs that were the high point of the working class, that they're now just almost McJobs. Temporary forever. Is heartbreaking. And it's no wonder that these workers have said, we've had enough and we're going to strike. Do you blame them? Now, my hope is they do come to an agreement. My hope is that they do figure this out. I don't ever want to see workers have to go on strike. It's always the last arrow in the quiver, because sadly, you know, workers, they struggle. And you have that mentality that we talked about earlier, that we're going to starve you out. We're going to deplete all of your savings. We're going to put you into bankruptcy. That's their mentality. Which, again, I keep saying, we need to adopt a striker. If you're in an area where there's someone on strike, adopt a striker. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.